We're going to start in Mishpatim, that's in Shemos. Actually, it's this week's Parsha. This week that's coming, the Shabbos that's coming. So essentially, Mishpatim is deals with the laws, the area of laws, which we regard to as between man and man. Between man and man. You know, the Torah is broken up into two categories of laws. There are those that are called between man and God. And then there are those that are called between man and man, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Between man and God means it's personal. That is your religious requirements in terms of your own self-perfection. So forbidden foods, that's not between you and anybody else. That's purely between you and God. So that if you eat forbidden foods, so then you have to make amends, you do tshuva. But the whole process... And you haven't violated anybody else's rights. No one else is involved. And it's a case of between you and God. However, if you've damaged somebody's property, if you've stolen from someone, I mean, there's a virtually endless amount of offenses, even if you've offended someone. By the way, verbal abuse is a prohibition of the Torah. That is, you're not allowed to, people think it's a bad thing, you know, it's not nice, and so on and so forth. That's the way it's viewed in most cultures. But in Judaism, it's not that it's not nice, it's also, it is a biblical prohibition. So these are the category of sins. Now, don't think because it's called between man and man that it's not also between man and God, because ultimately, you're violating God's law, God's will. So it's always an offense against God. But the nature of the offense is in terms of your relationship with fellow man. That's a major part of your existence. I mean, you can't live in this world and not have a relationship with people. And that, too, contains many, many aspects. That's a crucial element of perfection. I think it just in general... I think that there are many religious people. What would you say that people take more seriously? The area between man and man or the area between man and God?
Man and God.
You mean religious people?
Yes.
Yeah, I would think so too. That, and the more, I would put it this way, of course, this is just a generalization, so I don't mean it's true in every case, but the more religious you are, you tend to be, you know, the more zealous in religion, I think they tend to focus much more on the laws between a man and God. And that's where you'll find all the stringencies, and this is not enough, and, you know, there's a gazillion types of extra rules and so on and so forth. However, you will not find the same type of fire in the belly, so to speak, the same type of concern for the feelings of others, or, you know, the myriad of activities that people do that impact upon others. That's my observation. That's my sense, because those things don't appeal to the religious imagination. I give two reasons. First of all, they don't appeal to the religious imagination. The religion is the mysterious, it's the ritual, it's the mystical. The more mystical it is, the more appealing it is to a certain, not to me, but to a certain religious mentality. And I would say also, this is not my own, but I'm just sharing with you an observation of some other rabbi that I respect. If you think about it, at first glance, it may not seem this way, but there's an element of narcissism in religion. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
What do I mean? What do you mean? People would think, no, I mean, religious people are selfless. They're not narcissistic and so on. But I'm saying that there is. On a deeper level, religious people can be extremely narcissistic.
You mean like just because you're religious doesn't mean you're a good person?
Oh, that's for sure. That's another good way of putting it. You're right. But the narcissistic element is that what motivates a person to perform all of these rituals. so scrupulously and to pray with such fervor and so on and so forth. Now, it seems to me that it's possible. Again, it's not everybody, but there's a very strong selfish element there. He's doing it because he believes that this will be good for himself. He's going to get his special relationship with God, his special protection, his special security. That's why it's a source of, you'll see, like sometimes if somebody dies and they'll mention that so-and-so died, so people will express their, you know, regrets, and then somebody might chime in, and he was such a religious person. Like, that's a shock. As though if a person's religious, how could this happen to him? Well, it reveals a state of mind. It reveals the idea that if a person's very religious, then he's going to get a special protection. Now, if that is the case, if a person's motivation behind, the deeper motivation behind his performance of ritual and so on and so forth is really to gain benefits for himself, then you could see why he's not going to be as concerned as doing those things that are not immediately beneficial, putting himself out for others. And that's another explanation. Now, there's another reason. This is purely selfish. Look, there's nothing wrong with being selfish in your religious practice, as long as it's done intelligently. I always tell people, if you must sin, okay, I'm just saying that to put it in a slightly humorous kind of way. I'm not advising anybody to sin, obviously, but no one's perfect. Which would you advise them to do? If you must sin, choose which category, between man and God or between man and man? I mean, assuming they're both on, obviously, one is very serious and one is very, you know, relatively minor.
Man, nothing. And that's tough. I'm trying to think of, like, what laws a guy'd be breaking. Man, let's and just, God?
Well, why would I think
if I broke a law between man and man, there's, like, you know, I could go to jail?
Or, no, like, I don't mean that's practical. That's practical. I'm talking purely from the standpoint of religion.
God can handle your sins, but I don't like when I see religious people that are so into, can I eat this with this and eat this with this, but
I didn't hear the last thing. I'm not hearing you.
You dropped out on that last part.
I like the first part, and I just wanted to hear the last part. But I didn't get it.
My internet.
We can hear you now.
Oh, now I can. Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
I didn't hear the sentence from the but part. You don't like people that are so concerned, can I eat this and that, but take up from but.
And they don't hold the door open for someone, like common courtesy. It's just, I really think being nice to your fellow human is so important, because those laws came from God also.
Yeah, I hear that. It's very incongruous. It's like people want to get to shul on time. They don't want to miss, like, you know, Baruch or the Shemone Esrei, so they run and they bump into someone, so on the way to shul to pray to God, they're bumping into someone without even stopping to apologize. Right. I mean, there is a certain irony over there. But what's the reason, though? Why am I, when I'm telling you to be more selfish if you have to sin? By the way, the Gemara takes up this notion as to if a person has to sin, sort of gives him advice. What he could do, what he should do. That is, excuse me, even when you're sinning, I'm just throwing, because that wasn't my intention. Let me just throw it in. Even when you're sinning, use your head. Use your head. There are certain sins that are more stupid, more dangerous, and the more destructive than others. So it's wrong to sin, but we're human and we're going to sin. So even if that should occur, use your head. Use your head. If you have to sin, let's assume, with some sexual thing, that's it. You can't control your impulse. Okay, Don't do it with your neighbor's wife. You know, get a prostitute if you have to. Okay, that's much less of a violation on many levels. That's an example. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, doesn't God kind of like expect us to sin because he made us the way we are? But like, we can ask God for forgiveness for sins, but, you know, yeah, which is easier.
That's true. Because
like sinning with a person is harder for forgiveness.
But he gave us, God did give us the mitzvah of teshuva, the great institution of teshuva, that a person can repent. And if it is done properly, he is completely forgiven. It's wiped off the books, and he has a share in the world to come. The Rambam says that a genuine Baal Tshuva, someone who did Tshuva, is considered to be on a higher level than the person that never did Tshuva, that never sinned, let's say. So, no, God fully knows and understands that we are going to sin. And therefore, he gave us the opportunity. Because if that's the case, then man can't survive. If we had a religion that simply would not accept the fact that man is going to sin, that religion could not survive because everyone's going to die from sin. In fact, you'll find that even the greatest, even Moshe Rabbeinu sins, and Aaron, and even Miriam, so King David, the greatest people, sin. Not frequently, okay, because of their greatness, not frequently, but they didn't go there without sin. That's kind of an impossibility. The Gemara does list a few individuals who it says never sinned, but that's very complicated to understand for many reasons. But that's not my issue. But right now, I agree. The advice that I give would be you're better off if the sin is between man and God. But I'll tell you why. From the standpoint of tshuva, it's easier to do tshuva. Correct me if I'm wrong. It is easier to do tshuva if you've sinned against God, whether it be a sexual sin, whether it be forbidden foods, not putting on tefillin, whatever the case, even Shabbos. By the way, there's no sin that's beyond the scope of tshuva. There's no sin for which a person cannot do tshuva. Even the worst murderer, this is a little scary even to say it, that even a person has been a murderer all of his life. But if he did, we're talking genuine tshuva, not going through the motions. If it's genuine, and the Rambam says even on his deathbed, it's accepted, and he has a share in the world to come. Rabbi Soloveitchik takes up the question, suppose the Nazis had done tshuva. How would we regard them? I mean, I don't think it was possible for them to do it, but that's not the question. The question is, could Hitler have done tshuva? I don't think he had the ability. I think he was in the category of paro. Another thing is very interesting, and that is that at a certain point in time, and this is something you got to really be concerned about. At a certain point in time, a person really loses his free will. You see that in the case of Paro, that slowly but surely, he reaches a point where he's so stubborn, he's so set in his way that he can't, in spite of all the suffering that he brings down upon Egypt. He could not do tshuva and let the Jews go, except under the pressure of the plague of the firstborn. Well, that was not tshuva. That was simply he couldn't take the pain. And even so, as soon as they're gone, it doesn't take long, and he reverts back to his position and chases after them, you know, bringing down the entire army with him. But the reason I'm suggesting is that it may not be easy for a person to do tshuva. But what does tshuva entail? Tshuva has three parts to it. First of all, he has to acknowledge his sin, which is difficult for most people, because they can never admit that they sinned. Maybe they can say, I did such and such, but there's always the but. There's 25 buts. So really, ultimately, it's not my fault. I mean, you see that in the first case, in the case of Adam, when God confronted him if he ate from the fruit. And what did he say? The woman that you placed there with me, she gave me of the fruit and I did eat. So was that really confession?
No, he put all the blame on her, on Eve. He didn't take responsibility for his own actions.
Correct. He put the blame on her. And the rabbis also mentioned that in doing so, he was showing a lack of gratitude because Hashem had done him a good, because God saw that it was not good for the man to be alone. So he created the woman and so on. Now he was disparaging that. The woman that you placed there with me. So indirectly, he was blaming God. So you see that that's a very powerful factor in man. The inability to completely and unequivocally accept responsibility. I mean, I guess we could see it. We're all the same. We always are going to offend. When people accuse us of something and so on and so forth, it's very rare where a person just acknowledges the responsibility full without some kind of rationalization, some type of an attempt. The need to escape blame and to retain your own self-image of being a good person is an extremely powerful thing. I mean, it has its uses. Whatever exists, it does have its uses, because there are other people that don't have that capacity, and they're completely depressed. They're completely destroyed by their own sense of inadequacy. So a certain amount of defense mechanism is necessary. I don't mean to just get rid of that. These things aren't simplistic. They can be complicated and they can be dangerous. So the first element in tshuva, though, is to fully acknowledge responsibility for the sin. The second part is to feel regret. What's your attitude towards it? If you don't really care, so then that's not tshuva. But you should reach the point where you truly regret what you did. You see the harmfulness of what you did, the foolishness of what you did, the loss that you incur for what you did, and you feel regret. The third part is probably the hardest part, and that is to accept upon yourself the commitment not to do it in the future. That's not so easy. Essentially, you have to give it up. In other words, because if you don't give it up, so then how can you say that you regret it? And you don't want to do it. You want to get rid of that behavior. So that those are the three basic elements of tshuva. Now, if you do that, and there's a formula that you recite, and it's genuine, it's sincere, so then God forgives you. That's a pretty decent deal, I would say, isn't it? You're right? All right, there's different kinds of sins. Some are more severe, and some are not forgiven immediately, okay? But that's the general formula of tshuva. What about if you sin? That's if you sin against God. What if you sin against your fellow man? If you sin against your fellow man, then it's much more complicated, because then the rule is you do have to go before God. You have like two tshuvas to do. One is before God, but before you can do that, you've got to go to the individual you sinned against. And you've got to, not just, you have to apologize and express regret, but you have to solicit his forgiveness. So even if you apologize and express regret, but if he doesn't forgive you, you're still in trouble. You got to get him to forgive you. Unless you went before him a few times, and then you brought some other people, acquaintances, and he's like a crazy person, and he absolutely won't forgive you, because he can't forgive. So then you're absolved from that point, and then you just go on to do tshuva before God.
But that's only after three times, right?
That's after three times. That's why I'm saying it's easier to do tshuva. Don't forget, but tshuva with another person, see, you have to really humble yourself. It's an ego thing. There's an ego battle. To come before, it may be hard enough to admit you're wrong before God, but that's before God. I don't have an ego problem with God. I can humble myself before God. You can humble yourself before God. Right? It's God. Of course, I'm nothing. Who am I? I have no problem. I have no problem. But with your fellow man, it's always an ego battle. Because you know, you have your reasons of what you did and you think he's not that great. It's an ego. It's an ego problem to humble yourself before another human being. So that's my opinion, that it's much harder. Very difficult. Very difficult. And a lot of people are stubborn and you can't talk to them. So that's why my sense is you're better off not having to deal with them in this way. So you're better off not sinning against them. And even though it may be difficult and you want to say something and you feel you're justified in saying something, I'd be very careful. Wait, just go home. By tomorrow, you'll feel differently. By the day after, you'll feel even more differently. Forget about the whole thing. Because you may satisfy your emotion for the moment. Then it's going to haunt you. But maybe I was wrong, and maybe I insulted this person, which is a pretty serious error. To insult another person is very serious. To embarrass another person publicly, even privately, but publicly, is a very serious error. So that's why I say, if you must sin, let me put it this way. It doesn't sound right if I say, if you must sin before God. It doesn't sound right. If you must sin, don't sin against your fellow man. I'll put it in the negative. I think that's an important teaching. Any comment before we go further? Did everybody agree?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so let's take up part one. That's in Mishpatim. That's in chapter, I think it's 23. Yeah, chapter 23, where it says, there are two mitzvahs over here. If you should encounter the ox of your enemy or his donkey, well, it's lost. It's lost. Doesn't have to be, obviously. These are just examples. It could be a dog, whatever.
Where are you reading this from? 23?
Chapter 23, verse 4.
Got it.
If you encounter the animal of your enemy that's lost, you shall return it to him. Okay, so this is the mitzvah. You know, the Torah speaks in using a particular example, but it's a universal. And that is, it's another interesting mitzvah that I don't know that how many other societies have such a mitzvah, a law of returning lost objects. Returning lost objects is not not just like you're a nice guy and all that. It's a mitzvah. It's an obligation. So if you're walking through the streets and you find something, you find a lost object, you're not free to just move on. Because you're busy. You know, you want to get to work or wherever it is you want to get to.
It's a mitzvah to do it? It's not an obligation to return it?
Mitzvah is obligation. When I say mitzvah, I mean an obligation.
Oh, okay.
Literally, mitzvah is a command. Okay? But a mitzvah, when I use the term, there are some mitzvahs which are not obligatory. I got that. But this normally, I'll say so.
Right, because I hear mitzvah and I hear a good deed. Like, you did a mitzvah. You did a good deed.
You know, you're right. We use that term in different senses. But here, okay. It's obligatory. In fact, it's a very serious violation to just move on as though you don't see it.
Would it be worse to steal it or same?
Well, yeah, it would be worse. It would be worse. That's theft. So you have... the thing is like this, though. There's many laws. There's a whole tractate in the Talmud that covers this. Like anything else in Judaism, there's a lot of laws that pertain to it. So... the assumption, it has to be, there's two kinds of object. There are objects that we can assume that the owner has not given up hope of getting it back. And then there are objects that we can assume that he did give up hope. So, for example, money. If you're walking down the street and you find a $20 bill, $10, whatever, you can keep it. Why? Because the owner doesn't expect it doesn't have a sign on it. There's no way to know who lost it. So he figures that whoever finds it is going to keep it. So once he's given up hope on the object, he's sort of lost his ownership, so to speak. So you're not you can keep that, in other words. You can keep that for yourself. In general, the object must be one which is identifiable, and therefore the owner has, he still hopes that it'll be returned, because the person pick it up, they'll, it has a sign. The finder will give it to the lost and found, and he'll come down and he'll identify the object, and it'll be given back to him. But if it, again, it's got to be something which he can identify. Okay. That's there's two. We're not going into all of the particulars of it. I'll mention, just so you'll know, this applies only to a fellow Jew. I am not obligated to return the lost object of a non-Jew. Now, that's not because I don't care about the non-Jew. That's where you could say it's a mitzvah if you do it, in the sense that you don't have to, but you did it anyways. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. The reason is because this is an extra burden that the Torah is placing on a person, because they have to take home, especially if it's an animal, to take care of it, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of work involved. So, you know, there's greater obligations that you have to your family. If I said that this is true of members of your family, you have such an obligation, but to strangers you don't, you'd understand that, because a family works together and they do extra things for each other. The Jews have to view themselves that way. They're a family, especially a family that the rest of the world hates. So while it may be a good idea to do it for non-Jews and so on and so forth, the Torah did not see fit to make it into an obligation. But it did see fit to make it into an obligation for your fellow Jew. Okay, now let's continue. Hold on a second, I got to get a drink.
Sure.
Okay, now the next verse, the very next verse, adds another mitzvah, which is similar. If you shall see the donkey of your enemy, again, the enemy, laden beneath its load, and you would refrain from helping him, you shall surely help him. In other words, you don't feel like helping the guy, but you're obligated to help him, okay? So there's two mitzvahs over here. One is return of lost objects. Well, the other one, actually, the one with the animal and the load, that itself can be broken down into two mitzvahs. There's two situations that the Torah talks about. One is where you have an animal with a load. So there are two things. Sometimes the load was inappropriate, or it wasn't set right, and the animal has fallen under the load. So then in a situation like that, there's really two things that are needed. One is help is needed to get the load off the animal. That's the first part. Then the second part is reloading. Okay? So now let's say that's happened, that you're on the road, and you see that we have flat tires today, cars break down. So in those days, everything was with the animals. So you see a guy is stopped and his animal has fallen down and it's under the burden that it's carrying. So the owner needs help. That's why he says, you shall help him. Then you're obligated to stop, pull over, and help him to unload. Okay. Now, once it's unloaded, so the animal, of course, gets up, and then you have to help him to reload the load onto the animal. Okay. Now, what do you find strange about these two mitzvos? Which term is strange? Which term is strange? The term that's strange, or the question would be, why is the Torah referring to the animal of your enemy? In both cases, it says that if you find the animal of your enemy that's lost, then you have to return it. And then it talks about the animal that's laden under the load of your enemy. This is very unusual, because whenever the Torah speaks about relations between Jews and Jews, it always is your friend, your brother, and you shall love your brother. No, I'm sorry. You shall love your friend as yourself. You shall love. And all of the obligations, if your brother is in need and so on, he's always referred to your brother, or he's referred to as your friend. Because the assumption is, ideally, all Jews are good to each other, like each other. The reality is not that case. But on the level of the Torah, when it's referring to relations between one Jew and another, it doesn't refer to them as enemies. Yet over here, it does. So that's my question. Now, I want you to turn your Chumash to Devarim, okay? To Devarim. Okay. Now you have chapter 22. Verse 1. Says, you shall not see the ox of your brother or his sheep burdened, fallen down, and hide from them. I'm sorry. No, the first one is nidachem, means lost. If it's alamta, means like you hide. In other words, you pretend you don't see it. Rather, you shall return it to your brother. And if he's not close to you, then you have to bring it into your house. And it should be with you until your brother seeks it out from you. And then you return it to him, and so on and so forth. Then, immediately following, the same order that we found in the Mishpatim, you shall not see the donkey of your brother or his ox fallen on the road and hide from them. You shall reload it with him. Okay, so that's talking about the mitzvah of reloading. Now, what do you notice over here? It's changed. Suddenly, the exact same case. This is really just the repetition of the two laws that we're talking about. Okay, returning a lost object. And, there's two mitzvos with regard to an animal and its load. One is unloading and one is reloading, which I explained. So in Mishpatim, it's talking about unloading. Here, it's talking about reloading. But it's the same basic mitzvah. Okay? Now, the striking difference is that in the first case, in Mishpatim, contrary to the normal pattern, it referred to a fellow Jew as an enemy. Okay, well, we don't understand why, but then you'd assume it would be consistent. When this law is repeated in Devarim, this is the way all the laws would be written. It's suddenly your brother. You shall return the object to your brother. And you come upon the animal of your brother, and he's trying to reload. Here it's talking about reloading. You shall raise it with him. You have to help him. So you got to do both things. But like I said, it's interesting to note that here it it starts off by referring to this other person as your enemy, and then it goes on to, in the second instance, when it's repeated, it mentions it as your brother. Okay, so I think this tells us something. The mitzvah we're talking about here tells us something about the nature of mitzvahs. Now, the Rambam brings down the laws pertaining to these mitzvahs in the laws of, interestingly enough, in the laws of murder and guarding one's life. Okay. Now, he says that if someone who encounters his friend, here he mentions on the road, and his animal is laden beneath, is lying rather beneath the burden, then it's a mitzvah to remove it, to remove the burden. And he says, but you can't just remove the burden and leave the guy, you know, in that state of mind, like he's completely disturbed. You know the feeling when you're lost somewhere on the road and your car's broken down, you're in a certain state of mind, like bordering on panic. So he can't leave him like that, but rather he has to lift it up with, and once again, place the burden on it. In other words, you can't leave him until he's fit to go, till you've solved the problem. And he says if he fails to do this, then he's negating a positive command, and he's also violating a negative command. So that's pretty serious, this whole situation. Then he goes into, I'm not going to read through all the, this is in chapter 13 of the laws, that's the last chapter, in the section of the Rambam known as the laws of murder. And the reason why he places it over here is, He mentioned that if you abandon this person, what is the danger here? What's the damage that's being caused? Ultimately, he says that you might be causing this person to die, because you're talking about a situation. Generally, it's on the road. The roads, I don't know about today, but the roads in those days were generally unsafe, very dangerous place. So he says that since a person gets really worked up about his possessions, he's afraid to lose his possessions. So the person is going to get really, really worried. He won't leave. He should leave, you know, when it's starting to get dark, whatever, find shelter and all that. He won't do so because he doesn't want to lose his possessions. And that will cause him to stay there longer than he should. And it could lead to a loss of life. Okay, fine. Now, so there are two situations over here. Let's assume you come on two people. You encounter two people, one of whose animal is fallen and it's laden beneath the load. And the other one, the load has been removed, but he needs help to reload. All right, which one do you go to first? What's the order of procedure over here? What would you say?
I'm not sure.
All right. Anybody want to take a stab?
I think the animal that's fallen under the load.
Okay, good. Why?
That's a lot of work to help that animal. That seems like that's more, that takes more of...
effort, you're saying.
You're right.
Well, that could be, but that's subjective. Of course, it depends. In some cases, the law, you know. But, yeah. but the other thing you mentioned, though, is, see, the Torah is opposed to, the Torah is not indifferent to animal suffering. The Torah is opposed. It's called Tzar Bali Chaim. Mm-hmm. The suffering of animals. You're not allowed to... Actually, do you guys get my weekly Dvar Torah?
No.
Oh, I don't know why not. I've been writing it. I'm coming out with my book on Bamidbar. I have two books. Are you aware of my books?
No, but I'll check them out.
Yeah, they're on Amazon. It's called Eternally Yours. God's Greatest Gift to Mankind. I have one on Bereshis. It's out. And I have one on Shemos, which is out. It's a collection of articles. There's a number of articles on each Sedra. Okay, I think you'll really enjoy it. And then I have the, my newest one is Bamidbar, which is just about finished. That's got to press. It'll be out within days. But these are the articles that I write. I send out every week. You should ask Rabbi Rosenthal. I'm sure he'll make it available. I feel bad, but get this one this week. Because I do write a little bit about the issue of causing pain to animals. That's why the Torah is against hunting. Hunting, unless it's the hunting is for some kind of real need. We can't hunt for food because we have to kill the animal with shechita. Shechita is designed to be painless and quick. I know everybody rails against it, but it's not true. But the Torah is against animal suffering. You're not allowed to mistreat animals in a way that would cause them any kind of suffering. Okay, so therefore, in the case where the animal is lying beneath the load, you have the factor of tzar bali chayim, that the animal is suffering. In the other case, the load has been removed. So since the load has been removed, the animal is not suffering anymore. Now it's just a practical thing that he has to reload it and move on. But the other case comes first because there's an immediate need to remove the pain of the animal. Okay? Now the Torah goes on. Now the Rambam rather goes on and says that when is this the case? The case where you go to the unloading first is when both these people were either friends or both these people were enemies. But let's say one of them is a friend and one is an enemy. So let's say that the animal that needs unloading is a friend. And the animal that needs reloading, the case rather, you know, which needs reloading is an enemy of yours. So which comes first? Does that change anything? Because normally, as I said, all things being equal, you go to the case where it needs unloading because of the pain for the animal. Here, however, the case that needs unloading is your friend. The case that needs reloading, which there's no pain to the animal anymore, that is your enemy. Which comes first in that case?
Your friend?
I'm saying
why? Let's take one at a time. Go ahead.
Well, your friend, he's valuing your help, and you'll know he'll help you.
No. But we said that relieving the pain in the animal is greater. Yeah, well, I'm sorry. What did you want to say?
Well, I mean, he's your friend, but like your enemy is...
No, there's no mitzvah. Excuse me, there's no mitzvah to help your friend first. If a mitzvah is a mitzvah. If I'm doing something because it's a mitzvah, I don't know if that would be the case.
You're not getting credit for it if it's your friend? You're saying?
You're getting credit with God. If anything, I would say there's less credit that way, which I'll explain in a second, why there's less credit.
I get it. Because you might turn your enemy into your friend, is kind of what you're saying?
Well, no, we'll see. I want to give the other...
Yeah, so, well, it's... You would probably have to help the enemy because that's the...
Even though there's no pain to the animal, keep that thought. You probably have to help your enemy, even though there's no pain to the animal, because?
That's the harder choice.
Very good.
More difficult.
Very good. Because the Rambam says, in that case, you're overcoming the evil inclination. Because hatred is part of the evil inclination. And you see the high standards. Now we can understand why the Torah did speak about the animal of your enemy as opposed to the animal of your friend. Because listen, returning lost objects, let's be honest with each other. It's a big pain, okay? It's a big pain. And nobody wants to be bothered, right? You're coming home. It's been a day long. You want to get home, this and that. You know, like, I don't want to have to, and this thing, I have to schlep it, and this, and then I have to look up, and I have to, it's a big pain. So there's many excuses that you have to get out of there, okay? You don't want to see it. But you have no choice. You know, in the middle, you stop. And that's one of those moments. You see, that's a religious moment. That's a religious experience. When a person sees a lost object and he wants to get home and leave me alone. I want to watch the next installment. Okay, I don't want to miss the tennis match. And the person is going to go and then he just stops and he hears the voice from heaven. We're saying, if you see the, and he says, I got to do it. I have to surrender to God. God's telling me what to do. That's a religious experience. That's much more of a religious experience than when a person is shaking and davening and all of that. Okay? That's religious. That's Judaism. Those are what I call the championship rounds. That determines, do you really believe? Or is it just a convenient thing for you to make that makes you feel better about yourself? Those are the hard mitzvos. But I'll tell you one that's even harder. When you notice the obvious and you recognize it, it's a pocketbook or something, and you recognize it, and it belongs to that, I can't even use the name to describe her, okay? I can't say it, but, or him, what's the difference, all right? Who you can't stand, the person who just insulted you a few days ago, or last week in shul, this and that, you know, just walked by you, didn't even say, and it's that person's object, and I have to pick. What are you kidding? She doesn't deserve that. She deserves the fact that I'm happy that she lost it because she deserves to lose it. And so, and then you think back about what it says, the lost object of your enemy. So it doesn't have to make me feel good. It's going to make me feel nauseous, but still I'm going to do it because God told me to do it. That's the most, that's probably the highest spiritual experience you can have in this world. And you pick it up and you take it home and you drop it off the next day. And, you know, you say that I was walking home last night and I saw this thing and I recognized it and this and that, and here it is. See, that's what's going to happen is why? What is going to happen? Most likely, that person is not going to be your enemy for long. It's going to lead, you're going to hug each other and she'll apologize and this and that. And you've turned an enemy into a friend. And if you didn't, I can't guarantee results, but I guarantee you it's changed the situation. You've shown such an example. That's where you really believe in God. That's where you really say, I want my life to be directed by the dictates of Hashem, by the Torah, not by my emotions. Because by my emotions, your emotions, my emotions, the same thing. I'll treat you like you treat me. You don't deserve it. If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. You're not nice to me. Why should I return your lost object? That's my emotions, but that's not the will of God. So I believe that's why the Torah is saying, even though we do care about the pain of the animal, and normally you'd go to the animal to remove, but in this case, there's a greater good. The greater good is that the person overcomes his Yetzer Hara, his evil inclination, and raises himself to a higher level of service of God. That's even more important than the immediate suffering of the animal in the Torah's outlook. Because if that can be achieved, then everything else that the Torah wants to achieve can be achieved. It all ultimately, that's religion. That's the essence of religion in Judaism. People don't see it that way. It's the essence of the religious experience. And that's why I think the Torah established it this way. It started off by telling us, this is the only case, that if you should see the animal, the lost animal of your enemy, or you see the animal of your enemy laden beneath its burden, because it's telling us something. There's two kinds of mitzvos. there are those mitzvos that are more in line with your emotions. So let's say it's your friend. Okay. That's a mitzvah. If you return a lost object, even of your friend, it's a mitzvah. Yeah, but you can't compare that. There's gratification in that. It's your friend. You want to show what a nice guy you are, and he'll do things for you, and so on and so forth. So you don't have the emotional resistance against doing it. See, like there are certain people that are very sociable. You know, they always like to have company over and this and that. They enjoy it. And so you know, every Shabbos they'll invite people over and so, and that's a mitzvah. Okay, but who has a greater mitzvah? Let's say there's a person that doesn't enjoy that at all. Not sociable, not friendly, doesn't enjoy it. But they force themselves. And they do the same. They invite people over, and when they're over and they treat them really nicely and they show them, they don't enjoy it, but they do it. Why do they do it? Because God is commanding me. So who gets the greater mitzvah? Where's the mitzvah greater? See, in my opinion, the extent to which you overcome your emotion, your resistance, and act in accordance with the will of God, the greater the mitzvah. So when it comes to returning lost objects, which is a big pain in general, but it's a much, much greater mitzvah when you hate the person and you can't stand the person. And you're happy that they lost the object. You want them to suffer. And still in all, you overcome all of that and you say, I can't live according to my emotion. You see the great good, it'll carry over to every area of your life. You'll become a person that doesn't function according to their immediate emotions, but according to wisdom. But also in terms of your relationship to God. That's your whole relationship to God. I recognize my shortcomings, my weaknesses, and I'm committed to fulfilling the will of God. That's the highest level of religiosity that a person can attain. And I think the reason why, in the first instance, it mentions it as your enemy, in the second instance, it's suddenly your brother, I think is because that's a very, very, very good way of overcoming hatred. Because when you're forced to do something positive, helpful for someone that you don't like, you're looking at that moment, you're looking at the person in a different light, because now you've made this person into a pariah, disgusting. You can't treat him like you. Now you're recognizing that as a human being, just because he had one thing with you doesn't change his whole, make him into an evil person. And I still have to treat him as a human being and do good things for that person. That changes your attitude towards that person. It removes the hatred. And it'll cause the other person to respond to you, and that person will become your brother. So there is an important teaching over there. It's a new element. Our natural instinct is to dislike people, okay, that we feel dislike us or insulted us or whatever the case may be. And we don't really do much to alleviate that. But there are ways. Sometimes the emotions will follow the actions. Treating a person as though they were a friend, treating the person as a decent human being, that will cause your emotions to follow that. And it'll lessen the animosity that you feel for that person. And at the same time, it will have an impact on that person. So it's a tremendous remedy for alleviating the animosities and the hatreds that really, hopefully, should not be there among people from one family. Okay, that's the class for tonight. And this is my last class for the season.
It is?
Yeah, because I'm going to Israel. I told you this a while ago. Didn't I tell you?
Oh, I totally forgot. How long are you going for?
Well, we're leaving two Tuesdays. So next Tuesday is Rabbi Rosenthal. The following Tuesday, I'll be on the plane. So quite a while, though. We're going to be there rather through the next series of high holidays, which total of about 7 months.
Oh, nice.
That's awesome. I've always wanted to do Passover in
Israel.
Yeah,
I'm going to do Purim, Passover, and then Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot. So the all three holidays.
You're hitting them all.
Hopefully we'll hit them all. And I don't know. I'm going to do, you know, Rabbi Rosenthal has group that he brings to Israel in the summer.
Yeah, so, I've done both trips, the Heritage and the Fellowship. So that'd be great if you could meet up with them.
Yeah, definitely I'll meet up with them when they're in Israel and with him, of course. As far as this class, I don't see how it's possible, because this class is about 3 o'clock in the morning when it starts.
Yeah, I'm going to say that. What time is it in Israel right now?
Well, 7 hours ahead of you, and you're at 8. You started at 8, all right? No,
you'd have to start at 3 a.m. It's almost 4 a.m. right now.
No, that's an impossibility. So,
it says Tel Aviv, 3:58 a.m.
Right, yeah. It started at 3. No, I can't do that. If there was any, and you can't probably do, you can't do my time. So anyways, I really, really enjoyed the experience. It was great to meet you guys and study Torah with you guys. And I'm hopefully at some point in the future, I would tell Penny to forward my Dvar Torah to you guys. There's a new one every week. And I hardly recommend my books.
I'll do that.
They're not expensive. I deliberately keep the price down because I want people to read it. And like I said, it's eternally yours. It's on Amazon. And you have two so far, one on Bereishis, one on Shmos. And the Bamidbar one is, as I said, it's basically complete. Hopefully within days it'll be out there.
Thank you so much for taking all the time to do these classes. It's really nice.
Okay, my pleasure. I really enjoyed learning with you. Yeah, be well, everybody. Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I enjoy it. And hope we'll meet up again on good
time. Absolutely. Enjoy your time in Israel.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.